Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is United States v. Burt. Mr. Weinstock.
Good morning. My name is Adam Weinstock. I'm a law student licensed under Illinois Supreme Court Rule 711, arguing on behalf of the appellant, Charles Burt. Mr. Burt was deprived of his constitutional right to a fair trial due to the numerous evidentiary errors that occurred at his trial. Foremost among these were multiple instances in which the district court allowed inadmissible hearsay, including the testimony of two FBI agents, that William Martin, a previous witness, had made unduly prejudicial statements, which he later denied. The government introduced this evidence under the guise of impeachment. Mr. Martin denied that he told the agents that he had received sexually explicit images and had sexually explicit chats with Mr. Burt. Agents then called to impeach them, to impeach this testimony, had the intended and actual effect of having the jury treat this testimony as truth. William Martin was called for the purpose of impeaching this testimony as a backdoor to get the evidence in.
This struck me as a fairly routine instance of impeachment with prior inconsistent statements. What about it made it non-routine?
In this case, there were certain items in the transcript that indicated that, again, the purpose of calling Mr. Martin was so that his testimony, which the government could reasonably have expected to be adverse to its cause, could then be impeached.
And well, his entire testimony wasn't adverse to the government. He had plenty to say to support the government's case against your client.
Yes, but most of what was said by Mr. Martin prior to his denials were fairly innocuous comments. They were facts otherwise established, and they were not at all by themselves incriminating.
And how is it that you think the government should have proven up his testimony? I mean, how, if this was incorrect, doing it this way, what do they do when they have that kind of circumstance, or really any party, where you've got an earlier statement, the witness gets on the stand, testifies to something different? What would you suggest the government should have done?
Well, again, when the government has reason to believe that the testimony that they're seeking is not going to be truthful, then it's if they wish to impugn his credibility, then they should instead use more general means to do that.
And how are they to know that when he had a plea agreement, as I understand it, and in his plea agreement he was supposed to testify truthfully? And that, of course, would have some bearing on his sentence. So how was the government to be on notice that he was going to flip him when he took the stand on the crucial issues?
Mr. Martin did have a plea agreement in effect, but it was something that had already been exercised, and based on comments that he had made and based on his own behavior in his earlier interviews, there was no reason to believe that he would testify as to what the FBI agents later testified that he had said.
But of course, at the time he pled, his earlier statements were all of record, were they not?
Yes, his statements were during interviews.
Right, the statements that were in support of the government's position, those were all given prior to the plea. Then he had the plea agreement. I just wanted to make sure. And I can understand your point. You're saying that afterwards he might have been stalling or hemming and hawing in terms of it, but the government had that initial statement.
Yes, the government had that initial statement, but the statement was given under circumstances that Mr. Martin may reasonably have been expected to offer up merely what the government wanted in favor of his own case. And, again, there were allusions made to this at trial that he was had just been arrested. He was under the custody of the FBI, and he was likely to say anything that would help his own cause.
And those arguments were made to the jury, were they not?
Yes, those arguments were made during the cross-examination.
All right.
Moving on, there were additional instances of hearsay that occurred during the trial. There was the admission of a web chat between Mr. Martin and Mr. Burt, and excerpts of that chat that were admitted that included, among other things, the insertion of the names of Mr. Martin and Mr. Burt in place of the chat monikers that were present there.
Well, there was evidence establishing that those monikers belonged to the persons whose names were substituted, wasn't there?
There was evidence indicating that, but it's still a question of fact for the jury, and it's inappropriate for the government and for the court to allow evidence to be entered in that fashion.
Well, the jury was given a cautionary instruction on the substitution of the names, was it not? So if that's the case, what's the harm?
Well, the harm is that there's still the possibility that the names' presence on the chat transcript affected the jury's decision-making process to where they might not give as much credence to the idea that there was some uncertainty as to who's...
I hadn't both parties admitted or acknowledged that those were their chat names?
Both
Martin and Burt?
Burt had never admitted knowledge or had never admitted that his chat name was the one on there. Mr. Martin had stated that those names did belong to them. Mm-hmm. The substance of the chat itself was also problematic. It contained numerous statements, particularly by Mr. Martin, of a highly inflammatory nature, and not to get into the crudeness of them, but they were things that could reasonably be expected to inflame any jury of lay people.
Well, child pornography is likely to inflame anybody when just the charge, I mean, right?
Yes, it is. And it's a situation where, because of that, and because of the sensitive nature of the material, it's incumbent upon the court to ensure that no unnecessary evidence is entered to further inflame the jury. Finally, there was instance of a prior bad act that was used to establish a propensity on the part of Mr. Burt to engage in these acts, and that is an inappropriate use of that that evidence. Specifically, it was allegations deduced from one of the victims in the case that he had been molested by Mr. Burt. This was not directly an element of the crime charged. It did bear on whether Mr. Burt may have had a sexual interest in children, but that is a piece of evidence that was otherwise established through numerous means through the course of the case. And
the testimony was about the assault from the child was in validation of what was depicted in one of the images, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor. There were two instances in which children were testifying as to having been molested. One of them was in support of that depiction. The second one was in support of an occurrence that had not been recorded and was not brought up for evidence.
Well, and concerning Austin's testimony, the government says that it needed to establish in proving counts 1 through 7 that it was the defendant who used the three boys to produce the images and the charges rather than the boys just taking pictures of one another.
That's true, Your Honor. And again, that in establishing that, the government relied on a sexual interest in children on the part of Mr. Burt, and that's something that it took great pains to prove otherwise, and admission of the evidence of molestation is simply a case of, you know, taking a more inflammatory path and really putting it out there for the jury to be affected by the emotional circumstances surrounding the situation.
As I understood the testimony concerning the assault, Austin's testimony consisted of about a page of transcript. He gave one or two word answers. It wasn't any of the grisly details of the child abuse. Do you agree with that characterization of the transcript?
I agree that the answers given by him were one or two word answers. I would think that any depiction of molestation, especially coming from the child himself, would be grisly inherently.
Well, that's the nature of the crime, but I mean in terms of great detail, mm-hmm. that's what I mean by use of grisly. Like, it wasn't in great detail what the assault consisted of.
That testimony covered about 3 pages of transcript, and yes, it was mainly one or two word answers regarding the circumstances surrounding the events. Viewing all of these viewing all of these errors in conjunction with one another, it's clear that an intent existed to sway the jury using evidence that would not be otherwise admissible. Again, if I could return to the testimony of Mr. Martin, there was reason to believe there that Mr. Martin would not testify truthfully. The government itself indicated that it did not expect his testimony to be truthful, and it indicated its own desire to establish the content of those statements he denied making through the testimony of the agents that were later called to the stand. And because of this, any limiting instruction that was given in terms of limiting the use of that testimony to impeachment should be viewed suspectly. And this is further borne out by the government's own later characterizations of the testimony of the FBI agents as having been established fact on its own closing arguments. It argued that the testimony of the agents was in fact true when, again, the only purpose of it really should have been to question the credibility of Mr. Martin himself.
Well, but in so doing, if you question the credibility, doesn't the opposite, I mean, what he denied saying could be taken as true, right?
It could be taken as true, but it's not an appropriate inference to make. It's merely because he denied something, it should be used as an indirect question on whether, in fact, any of his testimony is truthful, and not as an inference that the truth of that statement did actually occur. I see I'm in a rebuttal time, and I'd like to preserve that.
Thank you, Ms. Weinstock. Ms. Bigger?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Monica Bicker, and I represent the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion with respect to any of the issues raised by the appellant here. With regard to the impeachment evidence offered against William Martin's direct testimony, as Judge Sykes pointed out, it was in the middle of Mr. Martin's testimony that he began to deviate from his prior statements that he'd made to the FBI. At that point, after the government made clear its intention to impeach Mr. Martin, the district court offered a limited instruction to the members of the jury. It did it several times. The district court offered this limited instruction during the testimony several times, explaining both in legal terms and also trying to break it down in layman terms that this testimony of Special Agent Brelsford and McDonough could only be used to evaluate the truthfulness of Mr. Martin's testimony. Setting aside the jury instructions later given, the jury was certainly admonished as they were hearing this testimony how they were to consider it.
I'm curious, after Martin deviated from the testimony and the trial was over, did he still get a reduced sentence? Has he been sentenced?
Yes, Your Honor. He was sentenced before the trial. He received, and that was in a different district, that was up in Green Bay, Wisconsin. He was sentenced to 50 years based upon his cooperation. And this is outside the record, but we did advise them that he had deviated from his cooperation agreement and request that his sentence in court be informed of that. I also want to straighten something out. Appellant mentioned in his argument that when Ms. Jenny Kendall was making her rebuttal argument, she referred to the statements that the FBI agents said Mr. Martin had said to them. In fact, she did. But when she did this in her rebuttal, she made clear that it was simply for purposes of the jurors determining whether or not Mr. Martin was telling the truth. And that's around, I won't obviously read this, but that's around page 619 of the closing argument, where Ms. Kendall addresses with the jurors, should you believe Mr. Martin? And she says, in essence, here's what he told you, and match that up with what the agents told you he said. It's all about evaluating his credibility. There's certainly nothing improper about that. And again, the jury is presumed to have followed the court's limiting instructions. So there's no abuse of discretion in admitting this evidence. Regarding the chats, the Starved Rock chats, there's no plain error in admitting the Starved Rock chats. First of all, there was no objection to it by the defense to the admission of the Starved Rock chats exhibit, and that's why the plain error analysis applies.
It might be plain error when you stick somebody else's name in that wasn't in there, right?
Your Honor, that's the second exhibit, which is the Starved Rock chat excerpts, and that was for demonstrative purposes only. There was certainly ample evidence establishing that those screen names were used by Mr. Martin and Mr. Burke.
Ample evidence, you didn't need to do it.
Your Honor, just as in a drug case where the government might put up a demonstrative exhibit showing transcripts from wire calls and certain defendants go by nicknames or anything else or don't use their names on the calls, for demonstrative purposes of explaining things to the jury, names will be listed by that and the court will tell the jurors, you are the ones who decide whether or not these people are the ones who made the statements. It's the same circumstance here. Mr. Martin testified that he used the screen name Be Some Smoke, and Defendant Burt used the screen name Starved Rock. There was also testimony from Special Agent Eileen Schmidt of the FBI that when Mr. Burt made a post-arrest statement, he admitted to using that screen name Starved Rock.
Before you go on in this, can we just go back a minute to the impeachment? Because one of the arguments counsel made was after Martin tendered his proffer, you had his statement, he pleads guilty, and then there was hedging after that time, and so the government was on notice that he might retract his statement at trial. You want to respond to that?
I'm not sure what they're referring to. There's certainly no evidence in the record of hedging on Mr. Martin's part. In fact, the last time that the government met with Mr. Martin was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, a day before his sentencing, and that may or may not be in the record because that may have actually come in through the testimony of Special Agent McDonough. We met with him. He expressed his interest in going forward with his cooperation. And did we have agents there ready to prove up any deviation? Of course we did. He's a cooperating defendant. The government always has to be ready for the possibility that a cooperating defendant may deviate from previous statements. But did we expect him to? No. In fact, in the government's opening argument, Ms. Kendall said, you will hear from Mr. Martin. He will tell you, and she laid it out, what he would say, all of those things that he had told the FBI previously. Moreover, he did have that plea agreement. We had every expectation and every reason to expect that he would comply with that plea agreement. And during the first third of his testimony, he did, in fact, abide by that plea agreement. And the evidence that he provided that incriminated Mr. Burt during that third of his testimony, in fact, was rather important. He said, in addition to saying that the screen names were he and Mr. Burt, he also said the images charged in counts 4, 5, and 8 came from his computer. And that was important because the agent who recovered that computer testified, but of course the defense could have made all sorts of arguments about, well, who knows if this was really his computer, and the FBI may have the wrong computer. We had to prove that interstate transportation. And there was Mr. Martin saying, that's my computer, I had it in Wisconsin, these images were on it. That was very helpful to our case. Finally, on the issue of the chats, going back to Starved Rock chats, there was ample, if the issue is just the substitution of the actual defendant's name for the screen name, there's ample proof of that. And the court did tell the jurors that this was an issue that they would decide. They were not to rely on that. And that was made at the time that they, that admonition was made at the time that the jurors first saw the starved rock chat excerpts.
Well, I guess my point was that if it's, the evidence is overwhelming or it's very clear, why do it?
Simply for demonstrative purposes, as is done with exhibits, like I mentioned before.
You only had two people involved here. This is not like a where there may be a number in a drug case, a number of people with nicknames or fictitious names or whatever.
And the government could have done it differently. There are a number of different ways that we could have presented that evidence. We chose to do it this way, and the court chose to allow it, and it was not an abuse of discretion because there was the ample evidence establishing that those names were accurate and because the court admonished the jury that it was their decision, not ours, who was speaking in those chats. Regarding Austin's testimony, that's the minor who testified that he was, in fact, molested by Bert. The images charged in counts 1 and 2 depicted Austin and were taken during the time frame that Austin testified that he lived with Bert. This was also the time period that he testified that he was molested by Bert. His testimony about the molestation covers about 1 to 1.5 pages of testimony. He gave one-word answers to my direct questions about what was done. There were no specifics, no graphic details. This was direct evidence because these pictures were taken by Bert during the time period that Bert was molesting Austin. And the government bore the burden of showing that Bert, in fact, took these pictures. Now, defense counsel, Mr. Green, argued that the boys took the pictures. He did this in his cross-examination of both the minors, Tristan and Austin, asking about their use of the cameras and whether or not they, in fact, took the pictures. He said in his opening argument that the evidence will show Bert didn't take these pictures. He argued it in his Rule 29 motion. This was the defense, in part. Bert didn't take these pictures. The government bore the burden of showing, yes, he did. And in proving that burden, meeting that burden, it's certainly direct evidence to show the context in which these photos were taken, the relationship that Bert had with Austin, which would include the showing that there was a relationship between them that would allow Bert to get Austin to take his clothes off and pose for these pictures. That is the direct evidence that Bert is the one who did this. For all of these reasons, there was no abuse of discretion by the district court in admitting this evidence, and we respectfully request that this court affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Weinstock? You have 2 minutes rebuttal.
Your Honors, if I may, I'd like to clarify the issue that arose with respect to impeaching Mr. Martin's testimony. Again, we don't argue that the government has no right to impeach his testimony. In fact, that is something that they need to be prepared to do. But in this instance, knowing as they did that adverse testimony would be forthcoming, it's something where they cannot utilize that fact to open up the back door to that issue. We're not here to question whether Mr. Martin had any wrongdoing. We're here to find out whether Mr. Bert himself is credible and whether statements that Mr. Bert allegedly made to Mr. Martin and Mr. Martin allegedly repeated to these FBI agents had any veracity whatsoever. And that's the very purpose of the hearsay rule, is to prevent questionable situations such as that from arising. In terms of the characterization of the government of this evidence, the government refers to a portion of the closing argument where it was stated, if you believe the agents, this is what was said. Shortly after that, the very language used by the government was definitively indicative that it was seeking the truth to be believed. An excerpt of this statement right here would be that on two different occasions prior to today's testimony, Mr. Martin said he received naked pictures from Charles Bert, and he said that Charles Bert told him that he liked to do devious acts with children and so forth. This is not an impeachment use of that evidence. It's a use solely for the purpose of establishing that context. In terms of the chat transcript, the replacement of the monikers with their names, it is demonstrative evidence, but it's evidence that is inappropriately prejudicial to the case. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Weinstock, you and your school were appointed to represent your client in this case. You've done a fine job. Thanks to the university as well.